Welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look at a couple of subjects in the news. We'll begin in a moment and talk about the just passed Medicare bill and the energy bill that's passed the House, but has been stalled in the Senate and will come up in the new year. And look at this in terms of what perhaps is a new kind of politics in Washington, and that is a move towards a one-party state in the sense that the Speaker of the House, Tom DeLay, has always had what he calls the K Street Project, which is where all the lobbyists are. And it's essentially what Tom DeLay, former pest exterminator, take-no-prisoners kind of guy, is doing to the wealthy the captains of industry and the powerful lobbyists in this country who represent the rich and powerful. He's essentially saying to them, you don't need the Democratic Party anymore, and we don't need them to pass legislation. And if you support us, we'll reward you. In fact, that's clearly what's happened with this Medicare bill, where federal tax, they've essentially opened the treasury to the HMOs and the pharmaceuticals, rather than use the power of government to control the prices of pharmaceuticals and bid them down. They're in fact doing the reverse. So we'll be looking into whether or not Tom DeLay's K Street Project is proceeding alive and well, and whether essentially there will be an alliance between the Republican Party and big business and the media, and more or less sending the message to all Americans that winners vote for the Republicans and losers vote for the Democrats, and essentially marketing the Republicans as a successful brand name, which is pretty much the way that Arnold Schwarzenegger was marketed here in California. So we're looking into whether or not we are heading towards a one-party, Timocratic kind of government here in the United States. We're speaking with Nicholas Compasori, who's an editor at the Washington Monthly, and he wrote an article fairly recently about the K Street Project called Welcome to the Machine. And we'll also go to Cairo and talk to Dr. Barjus Dodin, who is a Palestinian-American who is a professor at the American University in Cairo, as well as the director of University of California's Education Abroad Center in Egypt. And Dr. Dodin was just 2 days ago in Jordan, where he met with the Speaker of the Jordanian Parliament, a number of Palestinians from legislators, and also the Iraqi oil minister. So we'll be talking to him about what he learned on the grapevines from how President Bush's call for democracy in the Middle East is going, how the war in Iraq is going, and how much the Israeli-Palestinian issue still is the major irritant in terms of any kind of peace in that part of the world. And then we'll talk with Max Blumenthal, who's an investigative reporter who recently won the Online Journalism Award for his article, The Day of the Dead, which is a story about the murder of hundreds of women in Juarez on the border of Mexico. And we'll be talking about that story and how it connects to the ghosts of the pre-party and in the Mexican political establishment. And hardly ghosts. They're obviously ghosts don't kill people, but we'll be talking about the vestiges of that corrupt power structure and its role in this, and this unrelenting and unsolved killing, and its connection also to the maquiladoras, where many of the women worked. And we'll also look into a new story that he's working on, which is about how this local heir to the Amundsen fortune here, the wealthy son of the Amundsens, is fueling these right-wing Christian Reconstructionist ideology in American politics, and funding the split in the Episcopal Church against the ordination of the gay bishop and other activities. So we'll be talking about both of those stories in the last segment of the show. I'm speaking with Nicholas Compasori, who's an editor at the Washington Monthly and an author of an article recently in the Washington Monthly, Welcome to the Machine, about the K Street Project. And it would seem to me, Nick Compasori, that this passage of the Medicare bill last week is kind of a classic Tom DeLay strategy come true, where They didn't need the Democrats. They only invited John Breaux and Max Baucus into the negotiations. They basically, I think, snookered Teddy Kennedy, didn't they? Because he came out suggesting that he could vote for this legislation. But then since he was excluded, he didn't realize what they were loading into it at the last minute.
Right.
So it seems to me that they've proven their case. Now, the question, I guess the larger question is, do you believe that the captains of industry in this country and the wealthy behind the lobbying in Washington, would they be happy with a one-party state? Will they buy Tom DeLay's blandishments that you don't need the Democrats, you don't need to give them money, just give us money and, you know, we're much more efficient and much more effective and we deliver?
Well, you know, certainly Tom DeLay has the ability to hand down legislation and get it passed. In this case, as you noted, this is a 6,000-word bill, I think. I mean, thousands and thousands of words that won't take effect until 2006, but had to be passed before Thanksgiving at all costs, because the more people, conservatives and liberals both, read it, the less they liked it. It marries all the worst excesses of large entitlement programs and all the worst excesses of government pork for corporations.
But that would appear to be a contradiction. But I guess it's let's face it, the Democrats practiced patronage politics for a long time, mm-hmm. which is, you know, you basically make your constituents happy. Mm-hmm. So the first part of it is ladling the money and this budget busting amount of money that they're pouring in. And then the second half is taking care of the HMOs and the pharmaceuticals. So how do these, do you see them as being contradictory or complementary?
Well, you know, it's intellectually contradictory, but politically quite brilliant, that they are taking a bunch of taxpayer money, and they're using a bunch of it, most of it, to buy off a constituency, the elderly, and the rest of it to reward their allies in the business community. Here you have the AMA, which is concerned about Medicare reimbursements for doctors. You have the health plans, the HMOs, and if you follow this, you'll have seen that a former chief of staff to Tom DeLay, Susan Hirschman, basically ran the K Street operation here. She would have meetings over at the lobbying firm for which she now works, and she had over there the Chamber of Commerce, the National Association of Manufacturers, drug companies, HMOs, the AMA, and she basically ran the show such that K Street's resources and grassroots organizations such as it exists and lobbying resources were put at the disposal, essentially, of Tom DeLay to pass the bill that would do most to help the Republicans stay in power. So this is not really about ideology anymore. It's about power. It's a bad bill. It has no provisions for cost containment. You know, the old scam by which the drug companies can change the color on a pill and file again for the patent so it can't go generic is going to stay intact. You're not going to have any price controls with government bargaining. And they're basically bribing HMOs to compete against the more efficient Medicare system to prove the efficacy of free market health care. Mm. So it's a disaster.
But it's fair to say that the long-term goal and vision of Tom DeLay and the kind of free market fundamentalists is to get rid of the federal government. And by the federal government, the two largest programs are Medicare and Social Security. So is that still the goal? I mean,
I'm not sure if it's to get rid of them. It's certainly to abolish them in their current form. But what they realize is that voters actually like Social Security and Medicare both. And you can't actually say you're going to set out and dismantle them. What you can do is turn them into a resource for your party. And when you privatize Social Security and you put Medicare on the road to privatization, you're not reducing, you know, Medicare taxes or Social Security taxes. You're simply taking the power and money controlled by a public bureaucracy that can be run by either Democrats or Republicans and moving it over to K Street, over to businesses that are tightly allied with your own party, which is the GOP. Mm-hmm. And so instead of it being a kind of public function that doesn't aid your party in staying in power, it becomes a part of your out of government machine. So people are still going to have, if all this came to fruition, they would still have private investments account, which I think would be a disaster if people decide to retire during a downturn. And they'll still have health benefits from the government, but they'll basically be run after a fashion by businesses, which will earn money on that and pay back the Republicans with campaign contributions.
And in effect, it's pretty similar to what happened to the pensions. The pensions were held by trust and by conservative independent investors, and in the so-called pension reform, they allowed that money to go to essentially Wall Street money managers.
Exactly.
And people have found now that their pensions are worth half of what they thought they were.
Exactly.
So, but in terms of, Nick Confessori, in terms of the my general thesis, I guess it's a thesis based upon a kind of fear and dread, but it seems to me fairly clear that a guy like Tom DeLay, with that kind of former pest exterminator, take no prisoners mentality. And you get the feeling that in Washington now, there is really a bitter kind of wall between the Democrats and the Republicans.
Absolutely, it's a war of survival.
And there's no more of that sort of phony polytest that you used to have forever and ever when they're on the news hour saying, "I respectfully disagree with my learned colleague." You get the feeling that there's some real hatred going on there.
Well, I think Tom DeLay is trying to build something enduring. Right now you have a country that is basically evenly divided in terms of ideology. I think that on most questions, in a generic sense, Democrats have a slight advantage. So what the Republicans are doing, having momentarily taken the reins of power in the White House and the federal government, having gerrymandered the House to ensure they can control it for the next 10 years, and of course that there's actually a natural gerrymander in the Senate, since the mountain states and western states have disproportionate power. What you have basically is an attempt to build something that will endure even if voters turn against the GOP. If you can raise enough money, if you can control K Street, if you can stay in power in the House, you can win in the new kind of politics, the media politics, which is based on ad campaigns, not connections to voters. So he's trying to build something here, and he's trying to build the inverse of what the Democrats had after FDR for 60 years, which was an establishment built around taxing progressively and distributing benefits to a wide swath of the American public. DeLay's machine happens to only distribute its benefits to a very narrow part of the country, rich people and large corporations. But I think he is a take-no-prisoners guy, and he senses that he can use this moment of power to create something much more long-lasting than anything we've seen before.
But isn't it possible that this is not just Tom DeLay, that it's possible for the Republicans to, with the powerful financial backing that they have, with the support of people like Rupert Murdoch, who is effectively the Pravda of the Bush administration or the Republican Party, and if they can successfully market Republicans as a brand name and use the power of merchandising, which is clearly, if you can make the Republicans the Gap brand, or whatever the favorite brand is, you've got it made. Because look what happened here in California. I mean, they essentially ran Schwarzenegger as a brand. There was no substance to the political debate. I mean, clearly Davis was despised, but the long and the short it was, you didn't know what you were getting, but you sure as hell got sold something.
Yeah, but he could never have won in an actual election.
Well, no, he made more votes. He got more votes than Davis, so... The original argument that it was undemocratic, that the guy that won would have fewer votes, didn't actually pan out.
Right. Well, I mean, that there is obviously a long-term weakness in the Democratic Party, and the fact that Cruz was the best candidate they could come up with for the state that is supposed to be the most reliably progressive in the country is an indicator, I think, of just a substantial weakness in the party as far as the candidates it has, the talent it has as disposal. I mean, look at us now. The Democrats are relying on, six or five senators and a couple other basically has-beens and Howard Dean to run for president, and none of them have the kind of credentials we used to see as far as executive experience, except for Howard Dean as a governor. There is a weakness in the whole Democratic Party. I think it's not a new one. It's one that existed back when the Democrats were in the majority for so long, and it was a kind of atrophy that came with entrenched power. And the Republicans, by contrast, are an establishment party with a revolutionary outlook on politics. And DeLay will not stop, really, until the opposition is crushed. He is not content to see it emasculated and ineffective. He wants to see it gone completely.
And the Democrats, on the other hand, you know, if they're going to be painted as the party, if the Republicans are you know, going to merchandise themselves as the party of winners, if you give us money, we reward you, and if you vote for us, we reward you. The Democrats, the party of losers. I mean, is that a self-fulfilling prophecy? I mean, is it just going to be a kind of meaningless stew of identity politics of Hispanic, Black, gay, poor? Is that the way either they're going to be painted, or is that? I mean, in other words, DeLay has got a vision. It may be a rather scary vision, but at least it's a vision. Where is the identifying and uniting vision on the other side?
Well, there is none right now. And in fact, I'm working on an article for our next issue in the Washington Monthly, which talks a bit about this. But the institutions that bound the Democratic Party together for so long are basically decrepit now. The old establishment, the pre-McGovern establishment of the party, which was the smoke-filled room people, which picked great presidential candidates, by the way, Kennedy and LBJ and so forth, it's gone now. It's been replaced by a Washington establishment of pollsters and consultants and people on the Hill and the think tanks, which doesn't, in which there's no centrifugal power or force that can exert a lot of power on the party. And of course, the McCain-Feingold bill actually made that worse by depriving the Democratic Party institutionally of the one thing it had by which discipline its membership, which was soft money. And now soft money is in the hands of an endless array of labor and centrist 527 groups. So there's no person or institution that can say, here's the vision, here's the idea. And I think we're going to see in the next decade basically a kind of a sorting out of Democrats fighting and debating over first principles a bit until they come up with a winner. And we'll see what happens then.
So do you think that's what it really comes down to? I mean, because I've always thought that the simplest way to look at the two parties in this country are the Republicans basically don't want anybody to vote except their people, and they aren't a natural majority, but they sure as hell make sure, you know, with the Christian soldiers and their money, they get their voters out, mostly based upon anger and fear, but they get them out. The Democrats have a natural plurality. They should be able to get more people out to the polls, but they simply don't fail to inspire them.
That's certainly true. I mean, you know, it's funny. I talked to my dad, who will say to me, you know, I don't like Bush, but I wish the Democrats didn't make it so hard for me to vote for them.
Well, now, why can't they? What about this argument that I'm sort of this thesis that I'm putting forth here, that we're going to end up with a one-party state? That's what Tom DeLay wants. Doesn't the Americans, they've grown up, it's mother's milk, you have two parties. I mean, is the idea that we could go into a totalitarian mode, does that bother anybody?
I don't think we're going to see a totalitarian kind of mode. If anything, it would be a less toxic version of Mexico's old ruling party, the PRI, in which simply there was such an entrenched identification. And in a sense, you know, this is what the Democrats had. Years ago, you had even before McGovern, you had a party that was divided severely between liberals and conservatives and labor and elites. What mattered was that when you know, Daley in Chicago, you know, met in the smoke-filled room and they picked a candidate, he'd go and tell people to vote for that person. And people, you know, in those days, voters understood their place in the structure. And people understood that it was their place to vote for a Democrat or a Republican, like clockwork. It didn't matter what the ideas were. And since the 1990s, we've had much more of politics based on media and ideas. So I don't think either party has that kind of organic connection to voters, where voters think of themselves as Democrats or Republicans, except for a small partisan minority on both sides. So I'm not sure we could have the same kind of thing you'd have in Mexico. I think what you could have is an enduring majority, an enduring GOP majority, based in part on gerrymandering in the House, on the natural advantage of Republicans in the Senate, where Democrats represent something like 57% of the population and a 48% of the seats, and a White House where you can dominate by being supple and flexible as Bush is and raising a ton of money to win the media campaign. So I don't think it's not a machine in the sense of a voting machine. It's a machine in the sense of mastery of the modern form of politics. And I think they are well on their way to achieving that. And it will be interesting to see what happens in 2004, of course, when there's a single Democrat who's running for president who can articulate a message. We'll see if that solves any of the problems they've been having since 2000. I don't know.
But in the macro sense, what's happening is the rich are getting richer, the poor are getting poorer and more numerous, and the rich are getting richer and fewer. Mm-hmm. At least more and more money is being concentrated into fewer hands. You would think that at a certain point, the Republicans would run out of shills for the wealthy. I mean, that's what DeLay is he not? He's a shill for the wealthy.
And I think, at a certain point, yeah, it's a democracy and people will vote their interests. And I'm not sure the Republicans can continue the way they've been without trying to broaden their appeal. Now, this Medicare bill is a step in that direction, of course. It ticked off conservatives because it's basically the GOP is trying to buy themselves a vote. Right.
Well, it was very Clintonian, wasn't it? I mean, Clinton, yeah. Like with his welfare reform, he took a Republican issue and made it Democratic, and they've taken a Democratic issue and made it Republican.
Yeah, no, it's fascinating to see how that's going to unfold. I mean, Bush is a supple and maneuverable president, despite all the attacks he endures from Democrats. And his people aren't dumb. it is a question. At one point, I mean, this Republican establishment, until this Medicare bill came about, it does not distribute its benefits very widely. The Democratic machine, the sort of federal machine of the FDR and post era, mm-hmm. basically was it serviced a very broad electoral coalition, and that's why it endured. This one kind of depends for its existence on people not realizing what's really going on. And it's a question of how long that can be sustained. Probably pretty long. We have a pretty apathetic electorate here. Right. It's easy to manipulate the media.
Right. Well, people buy worthless stuff all day long in the malls. And,
exactly.
And they don't want to admit that there's anything, more to life than a good day at the Gap,
Yeah, we'll see if they have any buyer's remorse.
Okay. Well, I thank you for joining us, Nick Confessori.
Always a pleasure.
Thank you. Bye-bye. Bye-bye. Hello again. I'm Ian Marcer, just picking up with Nick Confessori, who's an editor at the Washington Monthly, and he's an author of a recent article, Welcome to the Machine, about the K Street project of Tom DeLay's, which appears to have been becoming entrenched and successful in terms of the Republicans becoming a permanent majority party and the Democrats being a kind of decorative and feeble opposition. Let's now go to Cairo, Egypt. I'm speaking with Dr. Bajis Dodin, who is a Palestinian-American. He's a professor at the American University in Cairo, Egypt, as well as the director of the University of California's Education Abroad Center in Egypt. And you were just in Jordan and in Palestine the last week. And I believe in Jordan you met with the Speaker of the Jordanian Parliament and the Iraqi oil minister. But let me first get a sense of what's happening in terms of Israel and Palestine. There's some indications that Sharon is trying to prepare his public, or at least his constituency, for some kind of a deal. But, they've been talking about this for years now, decades, as a matter of fact. It's hard to get to think that there's any serious negotiation going on at any level. But what's, give me a sense from the region.
Yes. First of all, what I met is was not. I don't know if it's the oil minister. He was the energy minister.
Oh, the energy minister. Yeah.
Energy
They tend to have a lot of oil in Iraq.
Yeah.
I don't know that they've got too many nuclear power plants.
That's correct. Yeah. With respect to what's happening, Sharon, and again in the last few days, we have seen all kinds of gatherings in Madrid and Geneva, and even in Jerusalem. I think Sharon is trying to beautify his reputation and stand after what he has done in the last 3-4 months of basically killing as many Palestinians as possible and making their life miserable. He has been criticized, as you know, when the European Commission conducted that poll. And also the CIA report to the Congress as well to the State Department, which showed that Israel has been hurting United States and the Middle East, and in fact undermining all our attempts in fighting terrorism in the Middle East. So I think the United States, in some sense, is telling Sharon, try to be a little bit more sophisticated in doing what you want to do, because after the CIA report was handed to the Congress and to the State Department, a week later, they approved the aid package to Israel, which is $60 million more than what it was last year.
Well, they deducted some $240 million, I think, because of the fans.
They deducted from the aid or from the loan guarantees?
Loan guarantees. Yeah,
you see, that from the loan guarantees anyway, which they supposed not to have gotten in the first place, right, to bail them out from the economic disaster they are in. But that's basically exactly what prevents Israel from going to the negotiating table in good faith, because they found somebody to guarantee their economic well-being, political well-being, and military well-being as well. If I'm in their shoes, perhaps I will not go to the peace table, given somebody is going to guarantee everything for me.
Well, but at the same time, it's not doing anybody any good. Now, I understand
by
making Arafat the problem, that is a recipe to do nothing, which is what the Likud people want. They've never really wanted to make a deal, in my opinion. It's been pretty clear.
Correct.
That they simply, you know, the peace thing is called a process. It's not about peace. It's about process.
Exactly.
And it'll go on. The agony will never go. Will continue forever unless somebody steps in and gives both the Palestinians and the Israelis some adult supervision, and that would appear to be the only people that can do that. But now it would be the United States. But now I understand that the Europeans and others, there's a movement also in Israel at the moment. People are getting some kind of ballot in or information about another peace plan that's been mailed to everybody in Israel. Have you heard about this?
Well, what I heard about was basically what's going to be signed in Geneva tomorrow. It has been circulated.
Right.
Naturally, some of the Israeli media welcomed it, but the vast majority condemned it. Sharon himself went against it. And if you recall, this Thursday, he gave a very important speech where he said he will go forward completing the wall at an accelerated rate.
Right.
He will legalize some of the illegal settlements. I mean, all settlements are illegal, but in his definition, whatever was not approved by the government is illegal. And he will go on, rather than dismantle them according to the roadmap, he will make them legal. But also, he's starting something which is very, very provocating, namely, he wanted to annex some of the existing settlements to be an integral part of the State of Israel, which means he's annexing certain parts of the West Bank to be an integral part of the State of Israel, which means they will be excluded from any future negotiations to be part of the so-called Palestinian state to be created at the end of, you know, the horizon.
But what's going on in Geneva? This is an attempt to go around the intransigence of both Sharon and Arafat, isn't it?
Correct. And what is going in Geneva, based on what I have read and seen, is reactivating what they ended with. If you recall, when they were negotiating under the supervision of Clinton and his aides in Camp David, they did not agree there. Then from there, they went to Taba in Egypt, in Sinai. Mm-hmm. And they continued negotiating until the last minute when Barak was defeated. So now Yossi Beilin, basically, and Yasser Abdrabbu were two of the chief negotiators at that time. They are taking that particular plan and carrying it further, putting more details in it. And I think it is within that spirit, basically. It's building on what was achieved in Camp David.
And they're letting the Israeli public know, because apparently everybody gets a copy of this plan in their mailbox, from what I understand.
Correct. Correct.
So I should give Yossi Beilin a call and do an interview with him, find out more about it.
But I think that will be very helpful for him and also for his counterpart, Yasser Abdrabbu, who was the former information minister under Arafat, before even Mahmoud Abbas became prime minister.
Let's turn then, Dr. Bajis Dadin. Let me remind the audience again, I'm speaking with Dr. Bajis Dadin. He's a professor at American University in Cairo, Egypt, as well as the director of the University of California's Education Abroad Center in Egypt. And just a few weeks ago, President Bush made a speech here in Washington and where he called for more democracy in the Middle East and specifically in Egypt. Now, if you had elections tomorrow in Egypt, you wouldn't be electing a bunch of pro-American Democrats, would you? You'd be electing the Muslim Brotherhood.
First of all, before I answer this question, I want to just be clear here. I'm speaking on behalf of myself, not as a
spokesperson for the
University of California professor or American University in Cairo professor.
Yeah, feel free to speak on your own behalf and be as outrageous as you want.
Some people in trouble, that's correct. Yeah, in fact, I don't know. I mean, in the long run, any democratic processes or elections anywhere in the Arab world, I am sure in the long run will be helpful and will serve the interests of both the Arabs and the Americans. But in the short run, if there are free elections in Egypt, based on what I see in the streets and the mosques, I would say without, in fact, hesitation that if it's not the Muslim fundamentalists, but let's call it Muslim leanings parties, will definitely take over. And remember, we just finished the month of Ramadan, where the call, the Eid al-Fitr, was last Tuesday. And that's the month of worshipping and crowding the mosques to pray at night and in the daytime and all of that. So the more desperate the people are, the more poor they are, the more, what I call it, angry they are, the closer they come to the religion.
Mm.
There is a lot of poverty in Egypt. Right. There is a lot of anger in Egypt, either anger toward the government or toward Uncle Sam, the U.S. government. And as a result, they feel in the Muslim-type parties at least a salvation, a way for social justice, something at least they feel they lived it through their history and they were comfortable with it, at least more than what they have now.
Well, now, the United States government, the State Department, are spending a lot of money. They're putting up radio stations, playing rock and roll with news broadcasts in Arabic, etc.
The Sawa.
But there's this idea that somehow we're not getting the message through to these people, that they're going to the mosques and hating America because they're not getting the full picture. To my mind, maybe there isn't anything you can do. I mean, our policies seem to have been to weaken secular states. I mean, some of them have been dreadful, like Saddam, but I don't see, is there, let me ask the question this way. Mm-hmm. Is there anything to build on in terms of secular democratic institutions in the Middle East? I mean, is there anything to build on, or is it automatically a situation where a bunch of despots are holding on by their fingernails, where underneath there's this turbulent, boiling mob of Islamists?
It's very, very difficult to build a secular, a democratic state in the Middle East at this point without giving those Muslim parties the chance to rule and then demonstrate they are incapable of ruling.
So that's like Iran. You've got to go through a whole generation of misery
Exactly.
Before you get to the point.
Let that mess at least get out of there. In fact, what if they indeed give them the chance and they fix all those problems? What's wrong of being, you know, so-called religious-oriented parties if they fix it? Long as the people want them, keep them.
Well, yeah, but the Quran doesn't tell you how to pick up garbage.
The Quran doesn't, but the Quran tells you that you have to love the others as you love yourself. You don't go steal from the government or suck the blood of the poor guys until they starve.
Right. Well, the Bible says a lot of things like that, but if the Reverend Jerry Falwell and Pat Robinson were running the United States, we'd have the same kind of thievery that's going on in Tehran with the mullahs,
I guarantee you. Yes.
So, anyway, it's a pretty...
But again, as I said earlier, maybe the people are reacting because what they have seen from the secularists throughout the Middle East brought them nothing but shame and poverty and injustice and lack of social justice, as I said.
Well, what are the chances now? You were just in Jordan and you met with the Iraqi energy minister and you told me before we went on the air that the poor man is scared to death, which is understandable because anybody that works with the Americans or any allies are being knocked off. And it's clearly that Saddam's people and Saddam himself was probably directing all of this. So the bottom line here is that this Bush administration, for all of their posturing and chest thumping around the world, they haven't done anything right, and they haven't finished any of the jobs that they started out. They didn't finish off the Taliban and bin Laden, and they haven't finished off Saddam. And both the Taliban and I don't think bin Laden's alive, but let's assume that he is. And Saddam, I think, is pretty clearly alive, seem to be making a comeback. So what's going on here? Because I noticed it when Blair and Bush were in London recently. There's huge demonstrations, but these demonstrations got eclipsed by the bombings in Istanbul, reminding any sensible person that there are people out there who hate and want to kill Americans and Brits and anybody who else supports their policies. So it's hard to love thy enemy. And, you know, you hate Bush on the one hand, but you can't be completely stupid and deny the fact that there are people like bin Laden and Saddam out there who wish us ill and want to kill us.
Well, I would not combine those together. I don't want to define...
Well, of course, Saddam didn't want to kill. He just wanted to kill his own people.
Bin Laden is a different story than Saddam. I don't think Saddam will go outside the borders of Iraq to attack anybody.
He's got his hands full within Iraq. He's too busy killing Iraqis.
Exactly. And based on what's happening in Iraq, I'm not sure all the killing we see in Iraq is also coming from Saddam and his thugs.
No, they've admitted, General Sanchez has admitted that some of the people they've captured are foreign, Islamic-motivated fighters, probably...
Not even foreign. I mean, they could be genuine Iraqis who simply look at the occupation as something to be resisted, period.
Well, the suicide people...
Saddam or not.
Right. They
especially after they got disappointed. I mean, there are so many people who welcomed the collapse of Saddam and the invasion and thought of the Americans as liberators, but 8 months later, all what they saw was false promises, basically, and a bunch of thugs, Iraqi thugs, who were on the run, who were running away from Saddam, they are brought back, basically, to replace Saddam. A lot of people think of Shalabi, for example, just to say, give you an example, is as bad as Saddam.
Well, the thing that they're just in closing, though, I'm trying to get some do a reality check here. As far as I know, that most people in the Islamic world, and in fact, the further away you get from the Middle East, apparently, the more extreme the numbers become. But something like in Indonesia, 80% of the Indonesian, most of whom are Muslims, believe that 9/11 was done by the Americans and the Israelis.
At least the planning part of it.
Right, and then after the bombing in last week in Istanbul, I saw interviews with young Turks excuse the expression, young Turks at the universities, saying it's the Americans and the Israelis are doing this. So I don't know how the Americans are ever going to fight this so-called war on terrorism if the people in the Islamic world who are the only ones that can stop radical Islamists is moderate. The only people who can fight.
We keep pointing at radical Islam, but in a way we never looked at why even those guys did exist. Why did they came about? Did anybody ever question this holy alliance between Israel and the United States? What if Israel really dragging Uncle Sam into all of these troubles? Simply to satisfy basically creation of a big Israeli empire. I don't know.
Yeah, but I can.
So this holy connection between Israel and the United States and having what's good for Israel is good for the United States is creating a lot of problems for the United States and will continue to do so. So as long as we identify with.
Yeah, but let's not get carried away here. Sharon is not behind bin Laden. But bin Laden's his own man, and he's doing his own thing. And his focus has actually been the Saudi royal family that he wants to get rid of.
I know, but you have to go back to Afghanistan and who recruited bin Laden, who gave him guns, and who brought mercenaries for him.
I agree with you.
Algeria,
I agree with you.
We
could spend the hours talking about
this.
I'm saying, how in the hell do you get out of this hole that we're in? This idiot president of ours has dug the hole deeper. And he's opened a can of worms that's just getting worse every day.
But that's not to say that we don't have a problem. He aggravated the situation rather than helped it.
Right. Well, look, let's postpone this conversation because I really want to get a sense of, is there any way to moderate the influence of radical Islam, to really stop people who want to kill us. And obviously our president is taking us in the wrong direction.
Yes.
But I'm not stupid enough to think that we don't have a problem.
We do have a problem, and I think it's solvable, frankly. I think the first step is for United States to go back to the United Nations and abide by the rules of the United Nations and also have one standard in carrying out the resolutions. Here's an example where we, in a way, punished Iraq throughout simply because of their violations of this word or that word of the UN resolutions. And yet here we have the Likud in Israel violating not only the UN resolutions, but violating even the U.S. arms export laws. And many, many other laws, and we turn close. Not only we close our eyes to his violations, but we reward him also handsomely. So I think the first step is to go to the United Nations, accept the legitimacy of those resolutions, and develop the same standard in implementing them, whether it's against Saddam or against Sharon or against Musharraf or against anybody.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us, Professor Dinwiddie, and let's do a follow-up soon.
Definitely. Yes.
Thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I'm just speaking then with Dr. Bajis Dodin, who is in Cairo, Egypt, where he's a professor at the American University in Cairo and the director of the University of California's Education Abroad Center in Egypt. I'm now speaking with Max Blumenthal, who's a freelance writer who writes for Salon.com and who just received an online journalism award for an article he wrote for Salon.com, The Day of the Dead, about how more than 325 women have been murdered in the free trade boomtown of Juarez on the border of Mexican-Texas border. And this has gone on for, decades, Max?
This has gone on. The framework for this epidemic of murders it was really created the day NAFTA was signed. You take a city of about less than 1 million people that was slowly growing with a highly corrupt government, a small police force, a small local budget for protecting its population. Suddenly, because of U.S. interdiction in Colombia, the city becomes the center of drug trafficking in the Western Hemisphere. And then all of a sudden, we sign NAFTA and send all of our factories on into Juarez. We send all of our you know, our major assembly plants in Juarez, and also because of NAFTA, because of agricultural subsidies, the south of Mexico is devastated. A lot of its farming community moves north for the jobs in the maquiladoras, which are the, you know, assembly plants there. And you have a situation where people become anonymous, where the police force can no longer keep tabs on its population, where the local government becomes a mechanism of ensuring, you know, investment rather than protecting its own population, and where workers become, you know, virtual slaves. Most of the workers in these that are preferred for these plants are women, because they're assembling small electronic parts. So they, you know, they want workers with small hands. They're hired on the spot. They're nameless, and they're not. And there's no protection. They live. Most of the women live in small shacks outside of the city, with no sanitation, with no address. Many of them have no families in the city. So when they're killed, they're anonymous. Half of the victims who've been killed have no name. They're unclaimed, and they just disappear into a sort of netherworld. And so that's the basic framework for what we have in this city. It's a city that is sort of, it was billed as a city that would become, you know, the laboratory of the future by the people who wrote NAFTA. They said that this city would become the future, and in a way they've been proven right.
But it's a future like a kind of 19th century mining town in Colorado, where it's just brutal. And I don't know if you've been to that little mining town up in Mono Lake.
I went through Colorado recently and saw the remnants of it.
Right. Well, there's one up in California, Lodi, I think it's called. It's just depressing beyond belief.
So, well, I mean, you know, it's also there's this, you know, postmodern element to it, sort of like reminds me of Blade Runner.
Uh-huh.
And what you have is just a model for the breakdown of civilization that's caused by, you know, a system that doesn't protect workers. You know, a system of unchecked free trade. So to understand the magnitude of that, I try to relate this to imagining that in the wake of it, during the sniper shootings in Montgomery County, Police Chief Charles Moose holds a press conference and asks local citizens to catch the sniper themselves because the local police can't do it and the federal government is not helpful, which is exactly what's going on in Juarez. And then imagine that the federal government charges the Montgomery County police with being complicit in the killings and preventing the investigation from going on. Just imagine what would happen in this country. I think we're seeing it slowly. We're seeing the beginning of that in Los Angeles with the grocery workers' strike, with Walmart moving in. You're just seeing the breakdown of a structure that protects workers. And when people become unprotected and anonymous, they become vulnerable. And in the same sense, when you have a population that loses the capacity for outrage, you make this kind of thing possible. So I think Juarez is something we should look at as sort of a microcosm for what could happen if there aren't some controls put on free trade and put on corporations like Walmart and Delphi and the Lear Corporation. And some of these corporations happen to have a huge stake in the mainstream media, which is why you see this story really not getting...
Yeah, but American workers here that want better conditions for themselves, they don't give a damn about the Mexicans.
Well, that's not true. You know, AFL-CIO adopted...
It's true. They've had some hearings on NAFTA recently pointing out that they've actually not benefited anybody.
Right.
I mean, none of what NAFTA was supposed to do has come true. Let's know, what is the connection, though, with all the murder of all these women, with the old dinosaurs? Is there any, because, I mean, they had the worst governors, these pre-governors on the border states there. They're all tied in with this this dreadful dinosaur who, you know, Echeverria, who's now they're trying to put on trial.
The guy, you know, the name slips my mind.
Bartlett.
The guy who, you know, signed NAFTA and sanctioned.
Oh, Salinas.
Salinas and his brother sanctioned the assassination of Colosio, who would have ever agreed to such a terrible document. So, I mean, right there you have a guy who's tied in with all the oligarchy of Mexico, and he signs a document. Overnight, more billionaires are created in Mexico than ever before. The upshot of that is that Clinton has to bail Mexico out of its banking crisis. But the governor of Chihuahua, which is the state where Juarez is at the time was one of Salinas's henchmen, Patricio Martinez,
right.
The attorney general, who's just corrupt beyond belief, Arturo Gonzalez Rascon, is also a priista, and all these people have, you know, a vested interest in seeing that the maquiladores stay there and that they're never held to account for, and that the foreign corporations are never held to account.
And Rascon is the guy that threatens some of the relatives of the victims.
Right, a number of the parents I spoke to, and by the way, most of the parents, because of the situation there with the law enforcement, the parents are handling the investigations on their own, and they formed a lot of private advocacy groups, and they're constantly threatened. One of the women I spoke to was, Rascon left a message threatening her on her answering machine, saying, "You have daughters that are still alive. Take care of them." The next week, a pickup truck followed her, and two men tried to abduct her. Most of the people I spoke to there, there were abduction attempts, there were destruction of their houses, threats on their answering machine. So, you know, you don't exactly have a society that's come very far from the era of Echeverria, when, you know, the leftists who questioned the government were buried in ditches. Right now what you're having is the women who just simply want to earn $5 a day and send it back to their families in the South are buried in ditches. So that's the point we've come to.
Well, let's just, in the last few minutes, Max Blumenthal, turn to the stories that you're working on now, away from the Juarez story for which you won the Online Journalism Award. You're trying to pin down the connections between wealthy heirs like Richard Mellon-Scaife and the Amundsen heir here in Los Angeles.
Right.
With, in the case of Amundsen, who's financing the split in the Episcopalian Church, in the case of Richard Mellon-Scaife, we know that he financed the impeachment or the efforts to find the evidence to have this impeachment of Bill Clinton.
Right.
Bin Laden and the Wahhabis who finance radical Islam, they wouldn't be successful but for the money. I mean, nothing happens in this world without money. And so much of what we see, it's the old Watergate adage, follow the money. I'm going to try to get a sense of perspective here on whether these problems and these so-called crises inside religion and these bogus reform movements, whether they would exist at all but for the kind of malevolence of these wealthy billionaires.
Yeah, there's no way that any arm of the conservative apparatus would exist without the efforts of less than 12 multimillionaires. There's no way that this movement would exist in any form. It would be a shadow. And just to put this in a nutshell and give some background, I'm focusing on, I've been researching Christian Reconstructionism for the past few months and focusing on Howard Amundsen, who's a local multimillionaire who's financing, he's the financial archangel of the Christian right, and he's a major reason why, President Bush is not going to be able to negotiate a peace deal in the Middle East. He's a major, because of Howard Amundsen's efforts, the following things would not have been possible: a ban on gay marriage in California, the 1994 GOP takeover of the California legislature, national welfare reform, the faith-based initiative, a mounting nationwide campaign to prove Darwin wrong. And what Christian Reconstructionism is it's a movement that's actually based in California that was founded by R.J. Rush Dooney. The idea of this is that it's dominionist theology. So the idea is to supplant civil democracy and secular humanism with a Christian theocracy, and they openly say this. In their theocracy, the federal government would essentially be eliminated except for the military. The death penalty would be instituted for homosexuals, witches, disobedient children, pretty much any outcast, pagans, which means Jews and Muslims. And if you think this is crazy, and it's not influential, you're wrong. One of George Bush's top advisors, the man who coined the term compassionate conservatism, is an avowed Christian Reconstructionist. who was published by Howard Amundson. The split in the Episcopalian Church that's going on is being financed by Howard Amundson, and what they're trying to do is to establish a separate church that that would sort of be almost the official church of the Christian Reconstructionist movement. It would create a new tableau for right-wing organizing, and it would destroy the foundation of the Episcopalian Church, which happens to be a highly progressive, one of the most progressive mainline churches in the country, and also one that openly opposes the Bush Doctrine. So that's where their interest is in that, and that's why I think Christian Reconstructionism is newsworthy.
So in other words, we know that the right wing, we know that the evangelicals, the 700 Club, Robertson, Falwell, that crowd, are basically a front for right wing politics. But Amundson and his money and Scaife and these people are trying to turn mainstream religion into a front for right wing politics.
Well, Scaife certainly is. Scaife is not religious at all. I don't know very much about him, but I've had, you know, a number of conversations with Amundson's wife, who's sort of coming out of the dark. Mm. And she, and, you know, these, her and her husband are full-fledged Christian Reconstructionists, which happens to be based on Calvinism, which is the wonderful reformist religion which gave us the Salem witch trials and provided religious justification for slavery and the extermination of the Indians. And
I imagine our Attorney General would not be uncomfortable with this.
I know his pastor, and he's influenced by Christian Reconstructionism. And John Ashcroft goes to a church in Washington which meets in a movie theater. And it's founded by this guy who was schooled in Rush Dooney and all the neo-evangelical thought that makes up Christian Reconstructionism. So, I mean, and that's hardly been reported at all.
Well, Max, I'm afraid we've run out of time here. When can we get this article? I want to hear more about it.
Well, I'm hoping to have it out this week.
On what?
On Salon, it'll be out this week on Salon.com, and we could do a follow-up or something.
Definitely, yeah.
Talk more about, Christian Reconstructionism and its role in the Bush administration.
Because I know that Bush himself is a part of this branch of Methodism, whatever it is, and Condoleezza Rice's dad was a Methodist preacher, so it's not... That's where the Rush Dooney, he's ostensibly a Methodist, isn't he?
He's a Presbyterian.
The
point of this movement is that it's a school of thought that seeks to make inroads into the mainline churches, you know, sort of underground.
Right. Well, their poster boy is Oliver Cromwell, who was a radical religious nut who took over a seated government. So if that's what their idea is...
Their blueprint for an ideal society is John Calvin's Geneva, which in 16th century Geneva, John Calvin... you know, established a harsh moral code on this city and personally oversaw 58 executions and 76 banishments. I mean, this is the society they hope to build, and it sounds unbelievable. And to me, when I first heard about it, it sounded unbelievable, but it's true.
I thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Marcer, just speaking with Max Blumenthal, who won an online journalism award for an article he wrote for Salon.com, and he's got an upcoming article, which I'm looking forward to, which we've just been discussing.
I thank Louis Vandenberg for the research and producing this program. I thank the engineer, Mark Maxwell.
This program can be heard on ianmasters.org on the net, ianmasters, one word, .org. Bye for now.